Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to Tides of History early and ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Apple Podcasts.
The first hints of pre-dawn light barely lit the gray horizon as two men on horseback clattered onto the castle's wooden drawbridge. The moat beneath them was dry and empty. Round, crenellated towers and battlements jutted up into the sky. A couple of board guards kept watch in the early morning. It was just another quiet day in Kent. Nobody had besieged this castle for decades, maybe even centuries. It was a symbol of power and status for the important noble family who lived here, not a practical defense. The riders dismounted onto the cobbles of the castle's courtyard. Their clothing was imported, black-dyed velvet, somber and understated, but extremely expensive. Their hats were of the latest fashions popular among Italian bankers. They carried swords, but they were just for show. The seal of King Henry VII of England on the rolled-up paper documents they carried was more than enough to stave off any interference. The sleepy guards snapped to attention at the sound of the horses on the drawbridge. They ran inside the castle to fetch the lord. "What's the meaning of this?" groused the lord as he stepped out into the early morning chill, wrapped in a thick fur robe. He hated to be awakened early, much less by two men like this. The men said they'd ridden all night from Westminster to this stronghold in the countryside of Kent. The lord knew them both, and he didn't much care for them. In fact, he was peeved that they'd show up here. They were the sons of lawyers and merchants. Their ancestors were dirt-farming peasants. The lord's grandfather had fought alongside King Henry V, the Battle of Agincourt. They were nothing beneath his notice. The men handed over the documents with the royal seal. They waited, quietly, as the lord broke them open and read. He couldn't believe what he saw. Allegations of treason? His jaw dropped. His cheeks reddened. Anger clouded his face. A financial bond? £10,000 if I step out of line? Do you know who I am? And just who do you think you are? The men remained silent. Emotionlessly, they bowed to the lord, just a little bit, and more than a little insolently, and remounted their horses. The lord stood in the courtyard, waiting to wake up from this terrible nightmare. Just as they crossed the drawbridge, one of the men turned and pointed, very purposefully, toward his saddlebag. He smiled ever so slightly. The saddlebag was embossed with the king's coat of arms. The man spurred his horse on and rode back down the rough dirt road. His companion laughed at some unheard joke, but the lord got their message loud and clear. Royal power trumped all. When it flowed through these men of humble birth, the lord's exalted ancestry counted for nothing at all. As the 15th century drew to a close, and the Middle Ages transformed into the period that followed, the power of the state rose dramatically. Kings wanted to do more, but everything was more expensive. To carry out their will, they needed ruthlessly competent servants. Today, we'll meet those servants and try to understand how they shaped the emerging early modern world. Hey, it's Patrick, and I've got some really exciting news. You can now listen to our entire back catalog completely ad-free, exclusively on Stitcher Premium. If you enjoyed our episodes on the Black Death, on chivalry, on peasants, that great interview we did with friend of the show Dan Jones on the Knights Templar, you can come back to that completely ad-free anytime you want. In addition to our archive, you can also listen to every new episode ad-free, as well as tons of other ad-free Wondery shows like Dirty John, Dr. Death, and American Innovations. Plus, with Stitcher Premium, you'll get access to hundreds of hours of original content, audio documentaries, and exclusive bonus episodes from some of your other favorite podcasts. You can sign up now for a free month of Stitcher Premium by going to stitcherpremium.com/Wondery and using the promo code Wondery. Then, once you're signed up, just download the Stitcher app for iOS or Android and start listening. That's stitcherpremium.com/Wondery and promo code Wondery. Hi, everybody. From Wondery, I'm Patrick Wyman, and this is Tides of History. Thanks for joining me. The last few decades of the 15th century saw a wave of massive political conflicts all across Europe. The Wars of the Roses paralyzed England for decades as warring factions fought over the control of a government led by an inept king before the unlikely Henry Tudor finally emerged victorious. Louis XI of France fought off repeated challenges to his rule, drawing his many enemies into webs of intrigue that eventually brought them down. One of those enemies was Charles the Bold, the last Valois Duke of Burgundy. His ambition for still more territory, on top of the vast and wealthy lands he already controlled, eventually brought him to the battlefield of Nancy, where a Swiss halberd ended both his life and his dynasty. In Iberia, the powerful kingdoms of Castile and Aragon suffered through their own upheavals, eventually uniting under the rule of Isabella and Ferdinand. This was a time of civil war and strife, of powerful nobles plotting with foreign rulers and each other against their king in defense of their rights. Kings pushed their own conception of what they had the right to do, and the result was deep and serious conflict. But out of those conflicts came consolidation. Powerful rulers swallowed up larger and larger chunks of territory. The major Italian city-states gobbled up their smaller neighbors. Great nobles lost much of their autonomy to centralizing authorities. Basically, the political map got simpler. This was the dominant theme of our last episode. We talked about the vast inheritance of Mary of Burgundy and how the Habsburgs of the Holy Roman Empire and the King of France fought over it. Mary died tragically young, but the legacy of her inheritance was two centuries of dynastic conflict. Through these decades of instability and war, dynastic states like France, England, and Spain emerged larger and stronger. Kings held more territory and had fewer rivals for power within their own borders. This meant they could focus more of their energy on intriguing and fighting with each other. We see the long-term effects of that explode onto the European scene with the Italian Wars, which began in the 1490s. Two tools allowed the rulers of these newly expansive dynastic states to accomplish their goals. First, ambitious, competent, well-educated civil servants, and second, increasingly complex mechanisms of state finance. Those two things were related to each other. They'll be our topic today. But before that, let's go back over what we mean when we say dynastic states. The historian John Watts calls them regnal polities. That's one term. Another valuable one that we'll come back to is composite states. Essentially, these political units were collections of claims to territories and other things bound up in the person of a ruler, usually but not always a king. On his, or less often her, death, the ruler passed those claims to territories and rights on to an heir. This was the dynastic angle. It was all personal. Everything was a family matter. Let's look at an example. So, prior to his untimely demise in 1477, Charles the Bold had been Duke of Burgundy, Brabant, Limburg, and Luxembourg. He was also Count of Flanders, Franche-Comte, Artois, Holland, Namur, and Hainaut. There were other claims, too. Each of those titles represented a separate claim, and each of those territories had to be ruled separately. To a remarkable extent, they retained their own institutions, elites, and traditions of governance. There were representative assemblies and officials, and the dukes often pretty much left them alone. Now, Charles the Bold's motley collection of territories also had its own central institutions, a quasi-royal court, officials who handled finance, law, war, and diplomacy, and a standing army. Charles wasn't a king, but he had competent civil servants, a financial administration, and a great interest in diplomacy. When Charles died, all of that passed on to his daughter, Mary. But those claims weren't absolute or incontestable. As we've seen, Louis XI of France immediately set about reclaiming some pieces of Mary's inheritance. Her eventual husband, Maximilian, had to fight and bargain hard to hold on to the rest. Charles the Bold and his Burgundy is a great example of all these trends because it's such an extreme example of a composite state. Four generations of powerful, resourceful Valois dukes assembled Burgundy out of nearly 20 formerly independent territories. With another couple of generations and a couple more acquisitions, it might have taken on the same solidity as any other European kingdom. Burgundy's competitors and contemporaries were no less cobbled together. The kings of France spent centuries eating up territories and marshaling claims to rights. The combination of Aragon and Castile, Spain basically, took place in the same decade as Charles the Bold's death, the 1470s. The last few decades of the Middle Ages saw a drastic acceleration of this process of consolidation. So, eating up claims to rights and lands was half of what made a dynastic, territorial composite state. The other half were the institutions the rulers of those states employed to do the business of state, and the people who ran them. Now, it's easy to think about state structures as abstract things, machines whose gears started turning of their own accord when kings told them to move. Taxes were collected, diplomatic business concluded. It's easy to put it in those terms as part of a grand narrative of the rise of the state. But that is not the reality of this period. Government was still personal. State finance depended on short and intermediate term credit arrangements with individual financiers. It was fiendishly complex and required expertise. This was a time of massive expansion in terms of what states were capable of, but states didn't rise because rulers pulled them up from the ground with their bare hands. Instead, kings relied on loyal and competent people to do the things they wanted to do. State building happened from the ground up. To understand who those people were and exactly what they did, we're going to need a guide. He's a composite character assembled from a variety of real people in the final decades of the 15th century. He's going to walk us through the life of a late medieval royal official, where they came from, how they interacted with the king, and why they matter. In the process, we'll learn about how these impressive-sounding state institutions and offices, exchequers and jewel houses and chancellors and inquisitions, actually functioned. So, I'd like to officially introduce you to our guide today. His name is Richard. We'll say that he was born in 1461 in London, the same year an 18-year-old Edward IV claimed the English throne in a series of bloody battles during the Wars of the Roses. Richard's family was upwardly mobile over the course of several generations. They were winners in the opportunistic economy created in the aftermath of the Black Death. We can trace the activities of ambitious and relatively ruthless families like this one over the course of decades. There may have been a land acquisition here, an advantageous marriage there, a legal suit over a business deal over here. It was mostly common families that produced the civil servants at this period. These were the people who administered the increasingly specialized and complex governmental machinery that drove the states of this period. The nobility, traditionally at the heart of royal administration, the king's partners in government, were gradually being sidelined. Richard's grandfather had been born to a penniless wage laborer in Kent. He eventually purchased his own land. Richard's father, the second son, had taken a modest inheritance to London and set up shop there as a merchant, where he married into an established family of traders. He specialized in wool, bought from individual pasture owners out in the countryside, which he then sold on to the big-time wool merchants of London. These major buyers ran what was called the Calais Staple, the wool export monopoly that ran between London and the port of Calais on the continent. Customs duties on that wool export provided huge amounts of revenue to the state. On the way out to the countryside, Richard's father's wagons carried low-value bulk goods like pitch and lumber imported from the Hanse merchants of the Baltic. His wagons rumbled back and forth on the muddy, rutted roads that ran between Kent and London, turning a tidy series of profits along the way. Like a lot of other ambitious merchants and wealthy peasants in this time, Richard's father had big plans for his son. He had made money, good money, in trade. He was looking into buying some nice property in the countryside, maybe even a small manor house with some tenant peasants. But his son, if he played his cards right, could rise even higher. Maybe he could even marry into the lower ranks of the nobility. The key to all of that was education. Starting in early childhood, Richard was tutored in Latin by the parish priest. Around age 10, he began to attend a grammar school with the children of other merchants, where he improved his Latin and began to master numbers and a few other skills. He also accompanied his father on business and picked up the tricks of the merchant's trade: informal accounting, negotiation, and a passing familiarity with the common law of the realm. Trade wasn't always the cleanest business, and lawsuits were common. No merchant who was worth his salt was free of suing or getting sued by business associates. In his mid-teens, Richard went off to university at Oxford. His Latin improved, and he fell in with a clique of students enamored of the new learning that was pouring out of Italy. This studia humanitatis emphasized the study of ancient texts, history, and rhetoric. It also produced a complex, stylized form of Latin composition modeled on the revered ancient authors. In Italy, the Studia Humanitatis was practical education for enterprising merchant sons and would-be civil servants. By the 1480s, that sense was beginning to take hold even in faraway England as well. The ability to write a letter in sophisticated Latin, to make a compelling oral argument, to quote from ancient authorities. All of those were increasingly becoming practical skills for men like Richard. After finishing at Oxford and picking up some familiarity with the fashionable Studia Humanitatis, Richard continued his education. With both basic and advanced skills already under his belt, Richard moved on to his specialist field, the law. In most of Europe, law was a professional skill set acquired in universities. Bologna and Padua were famous for the high-quality lawyers they turned out, many of whom went on to serve the Pope and various European monarchs. The rediscovery and intense study of Roman law had revolutionized the medieval monarchies of the 12th and 13th centuries, another time of rising states. This later period was less about what the law itself offered as a means of extending royal power, though that still mattered, than the future civil servants who were steeped in the law and its potential uses. In England, by contrast, law wasn't a university subject. Instead, it was taught at specialized locations just outside the city of London, which combined education, lodging, and professional associations. These were called the Inns of Court, and they still exist today. So, Richard would have spent several years training at one of the Inns of Court and learning the intricacies of the English common law. This skill set had both practical and theoretical uses. Practical, in the sense that the law was a potentially lucrative and useful profession, particularly for people with commercial interests like Richard's family, and theoretical, in that it tended to produce a particular kind of understanding of the role and necessity of royal power. It also influenced how those people thought it should be used. This was particularly salient in the 1480s, when our friend Richard was at the Inns of Court. Remember what was happening then. The death of Edward IV, the usurpation of Richard III, the murder of the two princes in the Tower, and finally the arrival of Henry Tudor. Looking back at their childhoods, young men at the Inns of Court, men like Richard, could remember feuding noble families, wreaking havoc in the countryside. They remembered cannons booming at the walls of castles held by rival factions. They remembered men-at-arms and archers riding off to be cut down in impossibly bloody battles. They remembered the decapitated heads of traitors staring down at them from city gates. It's no wonder that a generation of upwardly mobile lawyers who came of age at this point in time, in that environment, developed a strong sense of royal power and the common good. I should note here that I'm drawing on a really good recent book on this topic by Stephen Gunn called Henry VII's New Men and the Making of Tudor England. If you want to know more about this, this is the place to go. So, it's no wonder that a generation of upwardly mobile lawyers who came of age at this point in time, in that environment, developed a really strong sense of royal power and the common good. When Henry Tudor took the throne in 1485 and established himself over the next several years, he went looking for dedicated royal servants to help him buttress his rule. Young men like our friend Richard fit that job description perfectly. Again and again in their writings, we see the term common weal, public good, crop up. It's essential to understanding what drove guys like Richard into royal service. In this view of the world, the king and the forceful exercise of the royal will were the best route to guaranteeing the well-being of all the king's subjects. They were attached to a somewhat abstract idea of the state and especially to the king himself. This hadn't really been the case earlier. The nobles who had filled government earlier in the 1400s had personal relationships with the king that kept them loyal, not necessarily a theoretical sense of obligation to an abstract crown. There are echoes of this earlier in the Middle Ages, but nowhere close to this level. We're talking about England here with our friend Richard, but the kind of person he represents, of common birth, extremely well-educated, devoted to the idea of government, well, he crops up everywhere in later medieval Europe. We see him in the governments of Florence or Milan in the 1450s. We see him in France at the court of Louis XI in the 1460s. We see him in Burgundy with Charles the Bold in the 1470s. We see him at the court of Ferdinand and Isabella in Spain in the 1480s. And then we see Richard and his ilk at the court of Henry VII in England in the 1490s and beyond. They were harbingers of a new age in more ways than one. In the words of the historian Stephen Gunn, quote, they smack of seriousness, hard work, meritocracy, professionalism, efficiency, and modernity. But they were also unscrupulous. Their consciences were generally flexible, to put it mildly, and they ruthlessly promoted themselves by exploiting the weaknesses of their many adversaries. More than a few folks who ran afoul of men of this type ended up ruined or executed. But no matter how we choose to see them, they were here to stay. This was a common trend all across the continent, and it would define government for centuries to come.
If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/wondery. rocketmoney.com/wondery.
When you choose Organic Valley, not only will you be enjoying great-tasting dairy, you'll help to save over 1,600 small organic family farms who are protecting over 400,000 acres of organic farmland and all the plants and animals that call it home. This is dairy you can feel good about. It's great-tasting, high-quality organic dairy ethically sourced from small organic family farms. To find Organic Valley Dairy near you, visit ov.coop. That's ov.coop.
So our friend Richard completed his training at the Inns of Court by the middle of the 1480s, around the time Henry Tudor took the throne as Henry VII. Given his family's background, litigation over property and disputes between merchants became Richard's legal specialties. Drawing up contracts, making arguments in court, negotiating settlements, that kind of thing. He traveled across the English Channel to Calais and Flanders, where his clients had business dealings in the wool and cloth trades. As he accrued an increasingly wealthy clientele and made investments of his own, building on his father's business, he became acquainted with London's wealthy Italian banking community. Florentines, Genoese, Venetians, Lucchese. These were contacts that would become particularly important for him down the road. By 1490, Richard was an established lawyer and a budding businessman. Through his membership in one of the Inns of Court, where he took meals and socialized with other legal minds, he became acquainted with people working in the government of King Henry VII. We touched on Henry at the end of our second episode on the Wars of the Roses. His claim to the throne was desperately weak. He had much more French royal blood than English, and had spent his entire adult life in exile in Brittany and France. England was basically a foreign country to him. But despite all that, Henry had emerged victorious over the usurping Richard III at the Battle of Bosworth in 1485. That bloody victory made him a king, and his challenge now was to hold on to the throne. Through a combination of political talent, luck, and England's sheer exhaustion after decades of on-and-off civil war, Henry managed to cobble together a fragile consensus around his rule. The particularly desperate circumstances under which Henry came to the throne had long-term effects on his rule. Most of the nobility, the king's traditional partners in government, hadn't been on his side at Bosworth. He had no reason to trust them, and vice versa. Plenty of England's high nobles felt like they had every bit as good a claim on the throne as the up-jumped Henry Tudor. Much of Henry's tenuous support came from former Yorkists who had only bought into his rule because he'd married Edward IV's daughter. In 1487, Henry had to fight off a full-scale invasion that could easily have knocked him off the throne. He wasn't secure, and he knew it. The few people he could trust completely belonged to the small group that had been in exile with him. And this is where our friend Richard steps in. As I mentioned, Henry had some fiercely loyal associates who had spent years with him in Brittany and France. Several of them had a legal background, just like Richard, and would have been common sights at the Inns of Court. Thomas Lovell, for example, had been one of Henry Tudor's exiles and returned with him in 1485. After the victory at Bosworth, Henry named Lovell to one of the chief financial offices in the kingdom, Chancellor of the Exchequer. Even after Bosworth, Lovell retained his connections to his favorite inn of court, Lincoln's Inn, and filled various duties there. competent servants of Henry VII, like Thomas Lovell, were always on the lookout for new talent. The art of government was growing more complex. The king could put a sharp legal mind to good use. All Lovell had to do was look around when he took his meals at Lincoln's Inn or stayed the night. Our friend Richard was a natural candidate. He wrote in beautiful, fashionable Latin. He spoke several languages. His familiarity with accounting and business was an added bonus. Most important of all, though, he had the right ideas about the crown's legal authority. Richard and the other folks in this milieu really believed in the idea of the public good, of the king's power and his responsibility to serve it, and the role of the law in making it all happen. Serving the king also carried a variety of opportunities for material and social advancement, something an ambitious young guy like Richard would have been well aware of. So, Richard jumped at the opportunity to join Lovell and his colleagues. Given his background in business, financial affairs was a natural place for Richard to begin in royal service. There was a great need for that kind of expertise. In the later 15th century, royal finances were becoming drastically more complex all across Europe. Land management, financial bonds, taxation via representative bodies, customs duties, pensions, short and medium-term loans. These were just a few of the sources of revenue the rulers of this period tapped with ever more voracious hunger for funds. They needed that money because they wanted to do a bunch of expensive things. Namely, they wanted to make war. It's not just that war was pricey. It had been pricey enough to bankrupt England all the way back in the 1340s. But it was getting more so. Cannon cost a great deal of money. The fortifications that could resist cannon were even more expensive. Campaigns required purchases of supplies. Standing armies, which were increasingly common in this period, were a constant drain on resources even when they weren't out on campaign. We saw how that drove Charles the Bold to the brink of bankruptcy before the end of his life. The armies full of professional mercenaries that were increasingly dominating the battlefields of this period were likewise a huge investment. On top of the rising per-unit costs, rulers of this period wanted to fight all the time. Isabella of Castile and Ferdinand of Aragon spent years conquering Granada in the 1480s and 1490s, and then embarked on another series of wars in Italy very soon afterward. The Valois of France were on the other side of those Italian wars, which began in 1494. Maximilian, the husband of Mary of Burgundy and Holy Roman Emperor after 1493, fought constantly against an array of enemies, including France. Outside the dynastic states, the city-states were hardly less warlike. Venice spent most of the second half of the 15th century fighting a long war against the Ottomans, for example, and the rest of them weren't any better. Paying for all of that war required ever more sophisticated means of raising revenue and accounting for its expenditure. Now, by the standards of his contemporaries, Henry VII didn't do that much war making. He beat back an invasion led by a potential claimant to the throne, he suppressed a couple of rebellions, and he made a half-hearted invasion of France in 1492. England didn't have a standing army either, outside a small royal bodyguard. This might have meant that England didn't need the complex financial mechanisms of other states around this time. But because of his insecurity on the throne, Henry VII retained a lifelong obsession with keeping ready money on hand. Only large financial reserves would allow Henry to ship in mercenaries from the Low Countries or Germany on a moment's notice, to bribe foreign princes into giving up exiled enemies, and maintain the spying networks that sussed out treachery and treason both among his subjects and abroad. Because he felt his personal security and that of his dynasty depended directly on his revenues, Henry took an active hand in financial affairs. We can still see his spidery handwriting personally annotating his account books. He also sought out highly competent, ruthlessly competent, subordinates to carry out that business for him. An ambitious young lawyer with a family background in business, like our friend Richard, fit his needs perfectly. So, how did rulers of this time go about raising money? There were a number of different avenues. We'll use Henry VII as a handy example. So, first of all, there were revenues from the crown lands. As the name suggests, these were lands owned directly by the king. The king held a variety of rights over those lands, which translated into several different revenue streams. Tenants on those lands paid rent. The crops and goods they produced were sold at market. And there were a number of different feudal rights and potential fines that could produce revenue when exercised. Second, the king collected revenue from customs duties, both imports and exports. There were duties on all sorts of goods. Wool was the big one in England. I already mentioned the Calais staple, the royal monopoly on wool. But finished cloth, salt, and pewter were other exports that yielded substantial amounts of money. For imports, wine was a big moneymaker. The king could collect duties in both money and in kind. Third, the king could exploit his feudal prerogatives. These were not just a holdover from a bygone and passing age, but they were a key part of royal incomes. There are too many of these prerogatives to list, but the key one was wardships over the lands and marriages of underage heirs on royal lands. Other rulers might have more or less extensive feudal prerogatives than Henry, depending on the particular history of his or her kingdom. Fourth, the king might stick his fingers in any number of other pies. Henry VII, for example, was heavily involved in an illegal trade in alum. Alum was a key ingredient in the process of tanning leather and dyeing cloth, one of the major industries in England and the nearby Low Countries. Henry's trade in alum, as I mentioned, was highly illegal because the Pope had a monopoly on it. In theory, the Pope was supposed to use this money for crusading expenses, but he never really did. The fact that it was a monopoly good made the illegal alum trade exceptionally lucrative. Henry made a lot of money on this. Finally, the king had recourse to direct taxation, as long, that was, as Parliament agreed to it. While Parliament granted the taxes themselves and the rates at which they were supposed to be paid, royal officials were the ones who assessed the tax liability of individuals and regions. This was potentially the biggest moneymaker for a king, but it was hard to justify taxation outside immediate needs for war. Getting a representative body to agree to taxation also often meant having to give something up. When Maximilian wanted to raise funds from the Burgundian lands in Flanders to fight Louis XI in 1479, he had to give the estates of Flanders major concessions in return for the money. English kings had repeatedly made grants of rights to Parliament to fund the Hundred Years' War. Whenever possible, kings tried to quote-unquote live of their own, meaning their own revenues, so that they didn't have to go hat in hand to a representative body. In each of these avenues for raising money, there was a place for an ambitious, legally and business-minded royal official to tighten things up and generate more revenue. When our friend Richard entered royal service after 1490, he worked at all of them. He went out to royal estates in the Duchy of Lancaster and went over the rents owed to the crown. His work meant a few hundred extra pounds in annual revenue. While he was out there, he looked through old decrees and legal rulings to see if there were any royal prerogatives that might be pressed. He found them in the form of inheritance fees when leases were transferred from generation to generation. This was another few hundred pounds in revenue. When Parliament agreed to a tax in 1492, Richard coordinated with local officials in East Anglia to reassess the tax burden and found hundreds more pounds in revenue. But with Richard's background in trade, he did his most effective work on customs duties and special royal projects. He knew exactly how merchants lowballed tax assessors by undervaluing their goods. He knew how others tried to cheat the wool monopoly. He was particularly useful when it came to the illegal alum trade. He had been to the Low Countries. He knew the Italian money men of London. It was a simple matter for him to coordinate sales and route the money through the branch offices of well-connected Florentine or Lucchese bankers. As Richard pursued the king's rights and prerogatives to the fullest and generated big chunks of money in the process, our friend did well for himself at the same time. He pocketed outright fees from the crown for his services. But on top of that, he made his own investments in the alum trade. He partnered with the Lucchese bankers of London on sophisticated investments in annuities, perpetual payments on public debt from the cities of Flanders. Because of his position in government, Richard could pressure merchants he knew were cheating on their taxes into letting him invest with them at favorable rates of return. His friends at Lincoln's Inn tipped him off to investments in property, and he acquired several estates in the Kent countryside and a fine house near the Inns of Court. His city home doubled as an office. It had a counting room and extensive archives, where Richard and his growing army of personal clerks kept detailed records of his expenses and investigations. Above all, they kept copies of his letters, hundreds of them every year, to the targets of his investigations, to other royal officials like Lovell, to the king himself. His deep and thorough education, the way he'd been steeped in the written word, was the backbone of his professional success. He knew how to bully and badger those over whom he held an advantage, how to show his power. He knew how to cajole an unwilling but important adversary into doing what he wanted. He knew how to persuade with suave and elegant language. He knew when to drop in a fashionable reference to Cicero to a correspondent who would appreciate the erudition. All of those things were professional skills for Richard and his associates. By 1500, Richard had grown wealthy and notable. Like his compatriots in royal service, the kind of men Henry VII favored, Richard wasn't flashy or flamboyant. He dressed in somber but expensive black-dyed velvet, just like the king. Richard carried paper far more often than he carried a sword, but his power was no less real for that. The pen in his hand could bring down a crushing tax assessment and ruin a centuries-old noble family with a single letter to the right official. Just a whisper to one of his colleagues in government could bring charges of treason against a lawyer who was talking to the wrong dissidents within England. Especially the later years of King Henry VII's reign were notable for the climate of fear he induced among his subjects. One recent book on him is entitled Winter King, and it sums him up nicely. He was a shadowy and suspicious figure who governed through relatively unknown men like Richard. Trust was in short supply in Henry VII's England. To cement the loyalty of his most important subjects, especially the nobility, Henry turned to a devastating tool, financial bonds. This was a quietly brilliant legal and financial scheme. Bonds for good behavior were nothing new in English common law. If you violated a previously agreed standard or agreement, you paid for it. What was new was combining the concept of a bond with an expansive definition of treason. If a powerful noble or merchant was subject to a bond and did something the king didn't like, even something minor like associating with a suspect character, he and his heirs would suffer a financial penalty that would ruin their families forever. Treason was in the eye of the beholder, and the eye belonged to the king. Richard and his colleagues, sharp legal and financial minds, were the ones who administered this vicious and intelligent program. When Richard's black-clad figure arrived at a great family's doorstep, bearing the sealed document that represented a bond, the rising power of the king and the state couldn't have been any more obvious.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. FedEx offers fast delivery, more visibility, simple returns, and weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. population on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. With FedEx, you get picture proof of delivery, ensuring you always know where your package is. Returns are simple with packageless and paperless returns. Plus, FedEx Ground is also faster to more locations than UPS Ground. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. So, what are you waiting for? See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively, FedEx.
Men like Richard were both the velvet glove and the iron fist of government in this period. Shadowy figures who inspired fear among their many enemies. Henry VII's England was a particularly strong case of rising administrators, men of common birth who served the king with fierce devotion and serious competence. But they existed all over the Europe of this period. Their financial skills were often put to much more rigorous use than they were for the limited needs of Henry VII. The big reason for that complexity elsewhere, as I mentioned, was the need for money to finance increasingly expensive warfare. The normal revenue streams we talked about, like returns from royal domains, customs duties, and even taxation, just weren't enough to cover the expenses that came up. On top of that, time was a factor. Collecting taxes and customs duties and the like was a time-consuming process. It's not like the full measure of coin just appeared in the royal coffers overnight. It trickled in, subject to the evasions of taxpayers and merchants and the skimmings of officials. Mercenary soldiers staring down the barrel of a cannon or the head of a pike weren't just going to sit back and accept the promise of future tax revenues. To fill the gaps, states of all kinds, both city-states and the territorial dynastic ones, experimented with solutions. The obvious one was loans. Loans provided ready cash to pay those potentially angry mercenaries or buy cannon or what have you, and they could be paid back at some point in the future. What's essential to note here is that sovereign debt, the idea that states held long-term fiscal obligations to creditors, was a new and not especially widespread concept at the end of the 15th century. It wouldn't become the norm for a few centuries yet. So, in terms of how states paid for the things they needed, how they dealt with debt, this was very near a turning point. The real innovators in state finance at this point were actually city-states like Venice and Genoa, not the larger territorial states like England or France. All across Europe, it was these more politically compact and more financially sophisticated states that were the first to develop sovereign long-term debt. As a result, they paid lower interest rates on that debt. This is a big part of what allowed them to punch well above their weight in wars with larger, more populous states. This isn't really that surprising when we think about it. The political scientist David Stasevich wrote a really fascinating book on this topic, and he points to a couple of different factors. First, representative institutions were essential to securing the agreement for long-term debts. Those representative institutions functioned much more smoothly in city-states than in larger ones, simply because of the scale. Second, city-states tended to be full of people with liquid capital who were used to investing in financial instruments rather than land. They could assess the value of what they were buying and calculate the value of their likely returns. Moreover, those people with liquid capital were very likely to be well taken care of, to be important and well represented by the city's representative institutions. So, what did this mean in concrete terms? Well, it meant that city-states could take out an immediate loan for a large amount of cash. The city's elite might be compelled to provide a forced loan, which was a common financial tool across the late medieval and early modern world, not just in city-states. Alternatively, a banker or a consortium of financiers might voluntarily lend out the money required. Either way, the city would issue an annuity to be paid back at a fixed interest rate over the long term. These annuities could be passed down via inheritance or bought and sold on the open market. If this sounds familiar, it should, because this is still the basic structure of public debt today. But city-states were much better able to utilize this form of long-term financial obligation than territorial dynastic states. Why? Because investors trusted them to pay it back. Kings were riskier investments, and thus they paid more in interest. When, that is, they bothered to pay it back at all. The kings of France, like Louis XI, loved imposing forced loans on their wealthy urban subjects. The difference was that Louis XI simply treated them like taxes and didn't turn them into long-term, interest-paying financial obligations. Even when they did agree to pay back these kinds of loans, kings didn't necessarily believe that they were obligated to pay back their predecessors' debts. In fact, while Venice, Genoa, and a variety of cities and city-states all across Northern Europe had been experimenting with this for centuries by 1500, none of the major kingdoms had given it a shot by that point. It's not that they couldn't have used long-term debt either. We've already seen the fiscal woes of, say, England and France during the Hundred Years' War or Charles the Bold's Burgundy. Instead, these larger rulers were forced to engage with short and intermediate-term credit. This was more expensive, meaning that they paid higher interest rates, but it was still both necessary and useful for meeting their needs. I'll give you a concrete example of how this kind of credit worked for state finance. In 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue, as the old line goes. But Columbus didn't sail the ocean blue on a wing and a prayer. Instead, his first voyage was the result of a complex series of financial transactions and what amounted to a public-private partnership. A quarter of the capital for that first voyage came from the seaport of Palos, which provided the use of two caravels effectively as a tax payment in kind. A quarter came from a consortium of investors, mainly Genoese and Florentine merchant bankers based in Seville, headed by the Castilian court official Alonso de Quintanilla. The other half was provided by Isabella and Ferdinand, at least in theory. In the short term, the Catholic monarchs didn't actually have the money on hand. To cover their half, they turned to that same consortium of investors who were providing the liquid capital for a loan. The investors got paid back via an unusual financial tool. The proceeds from the sale of indulgences, remissions of sins, in the poor region of Extremadura. This last piece was overseen by another court official, an Aragonese named Luis de Sant Angel. So, to recap, the actual capital for this voyage came from a syndicate of Italian expatriate investors, half of which amounted to a short-term loan paid back via one of the crown's revenue sources. This was a labyrinthine series of transactions. What's remarkable about it is just how small the amount of money actually was. 2 million maravedis, roughly the annual income of a minor provincial aristocrat. For comparison, just 1 year of the military campaign against Granada around that time cost about 160 million maravedis. Most of that enormous sum would have to be cobbled together in the form of loans from financiers. In this case, that Aragonese court official, Luis de Santángel, was himself both an organizer of the whole financial package and a creditor. He lent 10 million maravedis on his own account, then paid himself back from crown revenues. Luis de Santángel and Alonso de Quintanilla, the Castilian involved in Columbus's voyage, were cut from exactly the same cloth as our English friend Richard at the court of Henry VII. Their skill sets and sentiments overlapped. Law, finance, keen business sense, loyalty to their rulers, a strong sense of self-interest, the burning desire for personal advancement. They were absolutely indispensable to the kings they served, the well-lubricated cogs in the machine of government that made everything turn. For them, royal service was a ladder. If they could grasp the rungs and pull themselves up, they would make their fortunes and greatly raise their social worth. Richard was the son of a middling merchant, the grandson of a man born a penniless wage laborer. If he served well and played his cards right, he might die wealthy and powerful. But these new civil servants, for all their power and growing wealth, weren't invulnerable. On a really basic level, they were deeply unpopular. It's not hard to see why, right? They assessed taxes. They hounded merchants to pay customs duties. They dealt with deeply arcane financial tools that few people outside the merchant banking elite even understood. In Richard's case, he carried out the strong-arming will of a deeply suspicious king and carried the threat of royal power everywhere he went. The practice of financial bonds in particular was seriously contentious. Not that anybody dared criticize it in public for fear of incurring the ice-cold wrath of Henry VII and men like Richard. All of this was made more prominent by the fact that these new civil servants, Richard included, were not of high birth. From our perspective, we might see that as a positive. These people were the cream of a rising meritocracy, we might say, for all that they rose because of their social connections in places like the Inns of Court. But late medieval people didn't generally think that way. Hierarchy was deeply ingrained into their way of looking at the world. People were born into a social position ordained by God. Nobles, men born to power, were the king's proper partners in government, rather than ambitious strivers like our friend Richard. Ascending commoners were inherently suspect. This wasn't a new charge at the end of the Middle Ages. Similar accusations had been thrown around for hundreds of years, whenever a king had a powerful, low-born servant. For example, Jack Cade's rebellion in 1450 had denounced, quote, mean persons of lower nature in Henry VI's government. You can find more examples, many, many more, over the preceding centuries. What was different around 1500 was the way those charges landed. They were more valid. Royal government relied on skilled, rising commoners far more than it had beforehand. In 1497, a guy named Perkin Warbeck, a pretender to the English throne who got a surprising amount of support, explicitly denounced, quote, "caitiffs and villains of simple birth." This was a big part of his pitch in trying to get people to join him against Henry VII, the king our friend Richard served. Men like Richard, according to Warbeck, were, quote, "the principal finders, occasioners, and counselors of the misrule and mischief now reigning in England." Warbeck's conspiracy and attempted invasion failed, but the accusations stung because they were true. Francis Bacon, writing some 120 years later in the 1620s, hit the nail on the head. Quote, "he," meaning Henry VII, "kept a straight hand on his nobility and chose to advance rather clergymen and lawyers, which were more obsequious to him, but had less interest in the people, which made for his absoluteness, but not for his safety." Richard and his ilk were effective servants, but they were broadly disliked, and they contributed to the ongoing resistance to Henry VII's rule. It was a catch-22. Much of the nobility disliked and resisted Henry VII from the start, which meant he needed to look elsewhere for loyal servants, which meant more dislike and resistance from the people cut out of government. Deceitful, glib, sharp-talking lawyers, men who, quote, "speak pleasantly and do overthwartly," according to the great chronicle of this age, weren't going to be popular. Richard served at the pleasure of the king. While he performed his duties admirably, he thrived. He accumulated cash, land, offices, and above all, influence. A letter here, a word there, the great families of the realm with noble lineages stretching back centuries might tremble at the machinations of a merchant's son, as long, that was, as he was carrying out the will of a suspicious and dangerous king. But when Henry VII died in 1509, to be succeeded by his 17-year-old son Henry VIII, things changed overnight. Young, vigorous, with his grandfather Edward IV's large frame and easy charisma, Henry VIII could be secure on the throne in a way his father never had been. At the end of the day, Henry VII had been a usurper. The sooner people forgot that and moved on, the better off everybody would be. This left the loyal and all too competent servants of Henry VII in an awkward position. Some of them, the least objectionable ones who had kept the lowest of profiles, could remain useful for his son and successor. Thomas Lovell, whom our friend Richard met at the Inns of Court, stayed on for years. So did Henry Wyatt, another longtime servant of Henry VII, who served as Henry VIII's guardian. Others were not so lucky. The most hated servants of Henry VII, men named Richard Empson and Edmund Dudley, were made the scapegoats for the old king's harsh and tyrannical actions. Both were charged with treason. But in reality, their crime had been the fact that they had done exactly what Henry VII wanted them to do. They paid for their competence with their lives. Both Empson and Dudley were imprisoned and executed very soon into Henry VIII's reign. So what did our friend Richard make of this? By 1509, when Henry VII died, he was 48 years old. He had made a fortune from his role as a royal official, supplemented with his own business as a lawyer and investor with ties to the rich and powerful merchants of London. Just as his father had wanted, Richard had married the daughter of a lower noble family, and he had children who might rise even higher. Perhaps he thought it was time to retreat from public life, to avoid tempting fate in a new and unfamiliar regime. If he did, maybe Richard sat at the heavy oak desk in his office, thin rays of London sunlight streaming in through the windows of expensive imported glass. He looked around at the files of papers lining the wall, the stacks of account books, the dockets of incoming and outgoing correspondence. In those papers, the history of a new kind of state power had been written. Richard believed, really believed, in the idea of good government. He believed that it benefited the people of England and that a strong king was the only route to providing it. Everything, from heavy tax assessments to devastating financial bonds, was worth it to provide order and good government. The fact that Richard had benefited massively from his role in that was not something he worried about. The historian Stephen Gunn sums this up nicely. Quote, there, meaning the officials like Richard, public actions were largely consistent with the principles of good government they enunciated. Though, of course, the kings and their definition of good government in matters of financial exaction and political control might not be the same as that of his subjects. All around Europe, kings and officials like Henry VII and our friend Richard were experimenting with new possibilities of governance and royal power. Kings could do more, fight longer and more devastating wars, offer much more thorough justice, pull in more revenue, reach deeper into the lives of their subjects. Whether those subjects benefited, well, that was something else entirely. Next time on Tides of History, we'll be exploring the Europe that Henry VII and his contemporaries fought and ruled over. Join me as we take a tour of the continent in 1492, right on the brink of great and terrible things. Until then, thanks so much for joining me. Be sure and drop me a line if you'd like to chat about the fall of the Roman Empire or the rise of the modern world. You can find me on Twitter at @Patrick_Wyman or on Facebook at @PatrickWymanMMA. You can follow the show at Tides History. Tides of History is written and narrated by me, Patrick Wyman. Sound designed by Derek Behrens for Airship. The sound engineer is Sergio Enriquez. Tides of History is produced by Leah Sutherland. From Wondery, the executive producer is Hernan Lopez. Thanks again for listening. Until next time, from Wondery, this has been Tides of History.
If you travel, you know how to pull off a perfect getaway. You know after you enroll with your Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card, you get up to $10 back monthly on U.S. rideshare purchases with select providers, like a car to the airport. You know which remote retreats have the best herbal baths and where the Wi-Fi password is rarely used. Because you're the escape artist. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Purchases must be on card. Visit go.amex/you know.